Well, good morning, everyone. It is my distinct pleasure to be with you again, and we appreciate so very much those who are visiting with us. I know that most of our visitors have not come all this way just to hear me, but I'm going to pretend that that was the case because it makes me feel good. But I'm glad that you are here. Yesterday we introduced this subject of the canon and emphasized the point about Jesus being the basis of canonicity and the men that Jesus put his stamp of approval upon being those men, their writings that we should be regarding as our inspired canon and have confidence in that. And so yesterday's lesson was an introduction to all of this. And so those of you that were not able to be here yesterday, you are in trouble because you've missed the heart and soul of all this. Last night in our question and answer session, I began by emphasizing that I wanted the members here to ask their questions so I could have an idea, a better idea of maybe what some of the particular issues are in this broad subject of canonicity, and I could then tailor my lessons today to address the specific areas and questions that you have. And boy, did you folks take me up on that, and you asked all these questions, and excellent questions, and I teach material on this that a lot of it really just goes an entire quarter. And so last night I get back to the haze and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I've got to kind of put together this and that and somehow condense all this into a couple of lessons today that would address the issues that you're asking about and discussing. And I will confess to you, it's a pretty tall order. And yet I've tried to do my best with this. I am sure I am going to just be touching on certain areas that you really maybe have further questions about you'd like to discuss further. I'd be very happy to not only discuss those in our question and answer session tonight after evening service, but after this morning service, if you want to talk individually or again even after we dismiss this evening, after our formal question and answer session, if you want to get together and talk further about any of these things, I'd be very happy to do that. And don't hesitate to ask about these things. I wish we had even a little more time to delve into these things even more so. But let me get right to it. And I believe, tell me how much time I have in this class session. Is there a buzzer? And about a quarter of? Okay. There's no trap door that opens up.
Yes, there is.
Very own. Well, I'll stand over here.
It's over there.
Boy, these elders are pretty quick here. Karen, as a preacher, you don't stand a chance for these guys. Let me tell you what. I do want us to emphasize, and I always come back to this point, that Jesus is the basis of canonicity. Not so-called church tradition, or not church councils and synods, and not the Holy Spirit that somehow testifies to a person's heart. All of those concepts, however well-intended they may be, are certainly not supported by these documents themselves. And Jesus is the true basis of canonicity, and those writings that come from the apostles and prophets that Jesus said would be guided by the Holy Spirit, well, those are the writings from those men that we know are the spokesmen for Jesus, and we can have confidence that then those writings are our inspired canon, and we need to use as our religious authority. Now, the fact of the matter is that when you look at these writings, there are many claims that people will make today that some of these writings are not actually from apostles and prophets, that they are forgeries, and I want to address that issue in the latter half of our lesson today. And then also there are many people who will claim that there are other books that really come from inspired apostles or prophets that are not contained in this collection of 27 New Testament books, as we call them. And so that's what I want to address also. Are there other inspired books that should be in our New Testament Bibles that are not? And so we want to address this. You will very often see books in the religious bookstores, or you will see in the tabloids, lost books of the Bible, or what they kept hidden from you. And of course, they make it very salacious and everything, or almost as if there was some conspiracy here that people have been trying to keep you, the average person, in the dark about these so-called lost books of the Bible. And a lot of people have made a lot of money in writing these kinds of modern books that talk about this as if somehow people have been left in the dark all these centuries. Well, that's just not the case. They're just kind of playing off of the lack of knowledge that the average person has about this. Let me just talk about some of the writings that are being referred to as supposedly books that should be in our Bibles that are not. First of all, you have the collection of writings that are oftentimes called the Apostolic Fathers. And these are writings from very late 1st century and really chiefly 2nd century authors. And they're referred to as the Apostolic Fathers because these were men who were disciples or had some contact in their lifetime with the generation of the apostles and prophets. So their life, they were early enough to where when they were in their younger years, most of them had personal contact with the apostles. And so they are sometimes called the Apostolic Fathers. And so you've got Clement, 1st Clement, and also 2nd Clement, which really wasn't written by him, but it's oftentimes called 2nd Clement, an elder of the church at Rome in the latter part of the 1st century, early 2nd century, the seven letters of Ignatius, elder there in Antioch of Syria, letter of Polycarp to the Philippians. Polycarp was an elder of the church at Smyrna. An account of the martyrdom of Polycarp, very interesting account of when he was executed because he refused to give up his claim to be a Christian. The Didache, the teaching of the 12 apostles, is the full name of that, and it is sort of a discussion of a proper Christian church worship service that was written in the 2nd century. The so-called Epistle of Barnabas really never claims to have been written by Barnabas, the traveling companion of Paul on his first journey, but has been associated with him. Actually, it's a 2nd century document. Shepherd of Hermas, talk a little bit more about that in just a second. The Epistle of Diognetus and fragments of Papias. Again, just some writings from men that, again, in their early years, their lives overlapped the latter years of the apostles. And so these are some writings that oftentimes people will say were written by inspired men, or they should be in our Bibles, and people ask about that. I'm just going to take time to introduce you to a couple of these to kind of give you an idea of the flavor of this particular literature. I mentioned Clement of Rome in the latter part of the 1st century. He was one of the elders of the church at Rome, and he wrote a letter on behalf of the church at Rome to the church at Corinth because they had learned that their sister church was having various problems and disputes among the membership. And it really is a letter from a group of Christians to another group of Christians, just urging them to settle their problems and just urging them to live in accordance with the apostolic teaching. Never claims to be inspired, never makes any claim like that. In fact, even makes reference to the Apostle Paul and his earlier writings to the Corinthian church. In fact, in chapter 47, Clement writes this, "Take in your hands the epistle of the blessed Apostle Paul. What did he first write unto you in the beginning of his gospel? Of a truth he warned you spiritually in a letter concerning himself and concerning Cephas and Apollos, because even then there were factions among you." You recall he's obviously alluding to 1 Corinthians, where you had the problem of the disunity and schisms that were beginning to emerge in the Corinthian church back then, and certain Corinthian Christians calling themselves and associating themselves with their respective teachers, either Paul or Apollos or Cephas. So Clement is referring back to that. He says, "But the faction of that time brought less sin upon you, for you inclined unto apostles of good repute, and unto a man approved among them. But now consider who they are that have perverted you, and have diminished the glory of your famous brotherly love." So he's talking about how when the beloved Apostle Paul wrote to you then, in that earlier generation of the Corinthian church, your church settled those problems. You heeded that instruction from the Apostle Paul. But now you've got a faction and you're not solving it. And so he is giving a rebuke of them and urging them as one Christian to a group of other Christians, do what's right. Solve your church difficulties there. Nowhere does Clement ever say that he's inspired. In fact, again, you even see he even makes a distinction between his own writings and those writings that actually did come from the inspired apostles. The Shepherd of Hermas, this is a writing that was written in the 2nd century, and it's a very interesting account of Hermas and his instruction from a shepherd or a pastor, and it's this visionary account that he receives. In some ways, it's kind of like the book of Revelation, sort of an apocalyptic type of vision, but urging faithfulness to the apostles and the Word of God. And this is a book that some of the earliest Christians, at least for a time, believed really was written by an inspired person. It actually was written around AD 115 to AD 140, so into the 2nd century certainly. It is found in one of the major copies of the books of the Bible that we have, Codex Sinaiticus, which was a manuscript from the mid-4th century. And it is interesting, as I said, that some of the early Christians, they apparently did cite this as scripture. They believed that this was an inspired document. Some of the Christians did. It was read in churches of the 4th century A.D. And again, it was quoted as scripture by Irenaeus and Origen. And this is certainly one thing that you see with some of these writings of the apostolic fathers. When you look at the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries, as we said yesterday, as these earliest Christians were circulating the writings of the apostles and prophets of Jesus, again, circulating them in a time unlike today, where it's much more difficult to circulate these documents, and you don't have the forms of communication and instant verification that you have today, there were some issues like this that arose, where sometimes there might be a church or a group of people who have a document that they believe is from an inspired person, is from an inspired apostle or an inspired prophet, there was some mistaken views about that. And so it takes some time for all of that to really come to light as to who the author was and all this. Well, this certainly was the case with this document, the Shepherd of Hermas. Let me just show you this. This is an excerpt from the Moratorian fragment, or the Moratorian canon, as it's sometimes called, written about AD 170. And it's a document from Rome and the church at Rome there that was commenting about this and the confusion that was known to exist about the Shepherd of Hermas document. And the fragment says this: Hermas composed the Shepherd quite recently in our times in the city of Rome, while his brother Pius, the bishop, occupied the episcopal seat of the city of Rome, or that eldership position, what's being talked about. And therefore it should indeed be read, but it cannot be published for the people in the church, neither among the prophets, since their number is complete, nor among the apostles, for it is after their time. So what I want you to see is that here the church at Rome was trying to resolve the confusion and the misinformation about this document that they had learned was spreading, but no, it was not one of the inspired apostolic or prophetic writings. It came from after that time, and they knew very well because it originated there in Rome. And so there are some of these documents where, yes, in the early decades of the church, or I should say the early centuries of the church, as these documents were being spread, as people in various cities were learning of these documents, getting copies of these documents, sometimes there was some misinformation. That's really not a surprising thing. When you stop and think about it, it really would be surprising if you never had instances like that. So this is nothing that really should bother us, but there's certainly no reason for us or for anybody to claim, as you so often hear, oh, well, these are lost books of the Bible, and they were kept hidden from you, and they were left out of the Bible, and they should have been in there. That certainly is not the case. Yes, the early Christians, sometimes some of these apostolic fathers' writings were regarded by some Christians as inspired for a time, and there was that confusion about them. But when you look at these documents carefully, you see that no, that those were mistakes. And over the course of time, those indeed were corrected. Now, let me talk with you about some other writings, because there are so many writings that come from Christian circles in those early centuries. And sometimes the terminology that is used to categorize these writings is the term pseudepigrapha, the New Testament pseudepigrapha. That's a big, long word that basically means false writings. Pseudos, false, and epigrapha, writings in the Greek. So false writings. From the 2nd to the 4th century, there were just numerous writings that various circles of people claimed to be Christians penned. And just some of these here, the Gospel of Thomas, a Gnostic work. I'll talk with you more about that in a second. Many of you have heard about that. That's been publicized in the media quite a bit. There's a later Gospel of Thomas attributed to the Apostle Thomas, both of these, but not actually coming from him. The second Gospel of Thomas gives a very fanciful account of supposedly Jesus when he was a boy and growing up, and I may say another word about that. Various other of these documents, accounts of the activities of apostles, the Acts of John, Acts of Paul, Acts of Andrew, Thomas, the Apocalypse of Peter, visionary book, very much like the book of Revelation, but this one is attributed to Peter. And there are just scores and scores of others of this early Christian literature written from the 2nd to the 4th century that is so often spoken of as pseudepigrapha, false writings. And the reason why it's called false writings is because they are attached in some way to these first century individuals, the apostles or prophets of Jesus, and yet these really are false attributions. They really were written much, much later, much after the generation of the apostles and prophets, and so they're generally called pseudepigrapha. Now, also, many of these pseudepigrapha are what we would call pseudonymous literature. That is, they are written as if that first century apostle or prophet is the author. Not just that they are about them or something, or about their alleged acts, but that they are supposedly from Peter, the Apocalypse of Peter. Or the Gospel of Thomas. And so allegedly, these are documents that are written as if they came from this well-known past figure. And the term pseudonymous is the adjective that is attached to this literature, and rightly so, because that word literally means false name. And so it's a false attribution of authorship here. These are works written as if they came from a well-known past figure. In other words, these are forgeries. That would be the term that we would most often use. Or the more technical term is pseudonymous literature. And this practice of writing pseudonymous literature was not really uncommon in some Jewish circles in ancient times, and certainly in some of the Christian circles, it was practiced. Hence, you've got the proliferation of this pseudonymous literature. I mentioned yesterday the Old Testament Apocrypha in the article, the packet that I gave to you yesterday. I have a whole article on the Old Testament Apocrypha. Also, we made reference to the book of 1 Enoch, which would be one of the so-called Old Testament pseudepigrapha. In other words, in Jewish circles during the intertestamental period, and then even a little bit beyond that, you had pseudonymous literature, works that were written as if they came from Enoch, as if they were written by Baruch, as if they were written by Jeremiah or some Old Testament character. And so this practice of pseudonymity was not an uncommon thing among Jews, certainly, in the intertestamental period. And then it also came to be practiced in some of the Christian circles. And so, hence you had this so-called Christian pseudonymous literature. And people ask the question, well, you know, why would anybody ever write something that really was a forgery and write it as if it came from a well-known Christian from the first century? Well, the motive apparently was not always negative, wrong kind of motive. Sometimes in the ancient world, generally, not just Christian circles now, I mean the ancient world generally, sometimes pseudonymity was practiced in order to honor a past renowned figure. In other words, it was a literary fiction and was not intended to deceive anybody. You certainly have examples of this among some of the Greek philosophical schools in ancient times, where there might be something that was written as if it came from Socrates, say, and everybody knew that Socrates had been dead for generations, and nobody was going to be deceived by it, and it wasn't intended to deceive anybody. It was a way of honoring that past figure, and the actual author was keeping himself in the background and paying honor to the philosopher in whose tradition he was walking. And so sometimes in the ancient world, pseudonymity was practiced and apparently had that kind of benign motive. But we also need to understand that sometimes these were just out-and-out forgeries intended to deceive people and to promote unorthodox doctrine. And real deception would underlie the practice. The purpose was to deceive somebody into thinking that this material that was teaching your particular false Christian doctrines, to deceive people into thinking that really had come from one of the original 12 apostles or had come from Paul, when really it didn't. And so sometimes you have this very malevolent motive here, shady motive. In fact, let me just kind of talk about some of these New Testament pseudonymous works that have become very popular. Many of you may have heard of the Nag Hammadi discovery in 1945, right around the time when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. In Egypt, along the Nile River there, was a cache of documents that came from the 4th century, and it turned out that this was library of 4th century Christian Gnostics. And Gnostics were a particular unorthodox false Christian group. In fact, so many of their teachings in seed form that later Gnosticism is condemned in the New Testament by the very teachings of the of the New Testament apostles and prophets. And so you've got really a false offshoot. The early Gnostics here were 4th century copies of 2nd and 3rd century Gnostic writings. And one of these is this Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. And again, many people have heard about this, and this is supposed to be one of those lost books of the Bible that should have been in our Bibles but was kept out, you know, and all of this. Well, the fact of the matter is that this is a pseudonymous work. It's a forgery. It's written as if it came from the Apostle Thomas, as if it's the Apostle Thomas who's recording these teachings of Jesus. And the beginning of it says this: these are the secret sayings that the living Jesus spoke and Didymus, Judas, Thomas recorded. And he said, whoever discovers the interpretation of these sayings will not taste death. That is Gnostic theology through and through. The whole Gnostic philosophy was this. Gnostic comes from gnosis, which means knowledge. And it was the concept that there is a secret kind of esoteric knowledge that only a few special elite Christians have. And so they were the elite Christians. And so these are the secret sayings that they were recording. And it was alleged that the apostles of Jesus presented this public teaching to most everybody, but Thomas was recording the secret sayings that Jesus gave to his disciples that were only for a select few. So this, of course, very appealing. Here was a Christian sect of that time that had adopted this. And so this is one of the last of the so-called secret sayings here that Thomas recorded. You women won't like this, but Simon Peter said to them, "Make Mary leave us, for females don't deserve life." Jesus said, "Look, I will guide her to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every female who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, about this time, I always kind of like to duck behind the pulpit and some women and start throwing tomatoes at me or something. But I'm not teaching that. This is teaching that, and it's false teaching. And this is certainly just part of that Gnostic view that in order to be closer to God, you had to be a male. And if you were born a woman, then you have an extra deficiency. And my wife would be very quick to point out that I'm the one with the deficiency. But in any case, these are the kinds of things here. This second Gospel of Thomas, a little bit later work, I told you, It is a very fanciful account of the boyhood years of Jesus. You know, if that part of this, folks, everybody always asks the question, well, you know, what would it have been like for Jesus growing up as a boy? What would it have been like for Mary and Joseph raising him? Did he play with the other kids? And what was it like in the carpenter shop? I mean, we have those questions. Well, guess what? Christians in the 2nd, 3rd century, they ask the same questions. And so somebody wrote this literary fiction attributed to Thomas. And again, I don't know if they were really trying to deceive people or whatever. It may have been just obvious as late as it was written. It didn't come from Thomas. But it's this account of Jesus in the carpentry shop. And in fact, he's really kind of a precocious brat. He does miracles he gets mad at the boys in town. They pick on him, it's just a ridiculous account. And when you read so much of this material, you see that the caliber of it is just nothing like the canonical scriptures. In fact, to me, one of the best things that I say to people is read this stuff. And it will be very obvious to you that the quality and the caliber is even the content does not compare, doesn't fit with the teaching of the canonical scriptures. There's so many things that are just in contradiction with it. This is the material that people are referring to when they talk about the so-called lost books. We need to understand the apostolic fathers and this New Testament pseudepigrapha material, they are not canonical. They were not really written by these apostles and prophets. Most were written after the apostolic era of inspiration. Most, for example, the apostolic fathers don't even claim inspiration. If you want to talk about writings that are the earliest and maybe come just after the apostolic era, you're talking about the apostolic fathers, but they themselves don't generally claim that inspiration, as I showed you the quote from Clement. And many, of course, of these are in direct conflict with the documents that we know for a fact came from those apostles and prophets of Jesus. They are in absolute conflict with this canonical teaching. And so there's just no reason for us to think that any of this material is actually from these inspired prophets, apostles and prophets. So I think what we have here are these true writings of the apostles and prophets, these 27, as it turns out, books that we have in our New Testament Bibles. And I believe that we can have confidence that these are true writings of these apostles and prophets. However, we do need to address this issue. And I kind of want to move on now to a little bit different issue. Many brethren are not aware of the fact, but I think we need to become aware of the fact, if we are not, that early Christians did have questions about the genuineness of some of these 27 New Testament books. And when I say that, here's what I mean. they had a question at times about whether some of those New Testament epistles really came from the apostle whose name is attached to it, or whether they might be pseudonymous works. And the reason why you have that kind of question arise is, first of all, what I said earlier, that that's a day and time where you have these writings that are being circulated, not with the kind of means that we have in our electronic era, but they are circulated and people don't always know in this area, well, now, where did this document come from? And they knew that there were a lot of forgeries that were there. So they wanted to be very, very careful. Okay? So I want to emphasize the reason for this. At times people that I've talked with, they get upset because they find out, you mean some of the early Christians, they had questions about James, or about Hebrews, or about 1 and 2 Peter, or about Jude, or Revelation. They had questions about those, and sometimes brethren get upset by that. Well, the reason why they had questions is because they were trying to be so careful and make certain that they didn't accept something as coming from an inspired apostle or prophet when really it was a forgery, when really it was a pseudonymous work. And the fact of the matter is that these books that are listed toward the end of our Bibles, the reason why those are generally put at the end of our Bibles is because when lists, say starting in the late 4th century, were made of those writings that were to be accepted as canonical, when early Christians would make such lists, they would, of course, start out with all those writings that were not disputed at all by anybody, but they would acknowledge that some of their writings, and they usually would list them toward the end, that some people had had questions about the genuineness, the authenticity of authorship of some of those writings. And so they do tend to be these general epistles that we have at the end of our Bibles, and it is certainly true that some of the early Christians in those early centuries did have some questions and were having to address those questions about whether or not some of those writings might not be pseudonymous. They were concerned about that. Now, here's what's happened in our modern time. Modern scholarship, which generally is liberal, modern liberal scholarship not only tends to reject as authentic these writings here, or most of these writings here that the early Christians had some questions about, but modern liberal scholarship goes even further and even rejects several more, and confidently and categorically rejects so many of these New Testament books that never came into question, that there was certainly a uniform acceptance in the early Christian years. But modern scholars very often reject so many of these. The ones I have in the orange card here, Ephesians and Colossians, are generally rejected by modern liberal scholars as not really having been written by Paul. Or 2 Thessalonians is oftentimes claimed to be a pseudonymous letter. It wasn't really written by Paul. The so-called pastoral epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Virtually all scholars in our modern day, it's just sort of a standard liberal position that isn't even questioned by them. It's just, if you're a scholar, you just accept this, that Paul did not really write 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Those documents were not questioned in the early church. It's true that some of these were, but eventually those questions were resolved. But modern scholars have said, well, all of these that I've got highlighted there, all of those are rejected. In fact, it's generally said that only 7 authentically Pauline letters, and some have even gone further and said, maybe only 5. You really can't write. It's just kind of, you jump on the bandwagon of scholarship and start saying all of this. Well, I teach an entire quarter course where this is the chief issue that we address. So I can't talk in depth about all of this. But let me, in just the time I have left in this class and then in the sermon time, let me try to address some of these issues. Ephesians and Colossians, you know, why is it that modern scholars reject that as those documents as really coming from Paul? Why are they treated as pseudonymous? I don't believe that the reasons are valid. But here's what is claimed. Well, they differ from Paul's other epistles in their vocabulary. There are words, say, that you find in Colossians and some in Ephesians that you don't find in Paul's other epistles, or you certainly don't find with the predominance in Paul's other epistles. And so that is very oftentimes used as some evidence that Paul couldn't have written Ephesians or Colossians. Which to me is always amazing, especially when you realize that Paul's addressing these particular churches with their special problems, especially Colossians is that way. Well, of course he's going to be using different terminology in addressing the Colossian heresy, which was a unique kind of heresy, different from what he would be writing about when he writes Romans, which has a completely different purpose. Or the style is different. And very often, people will say, well, Ephesians is a different style than Paul's other letters. As if every single letter that you ever write is always exactly in style like every other letter you've written. And can you imagine someone using a criterion like that to try to prove categorically, well, you really didn't like this letter, and it's obviously a forgery. You know? Or there are doctrinal differences that Paul emphasizes some doctrines in Ephesians and Colossians that you don't see in his other letters, or there are some doctrines he emphasizes in the other letters that you don't see him emphasizing in Ephesians and Colossians. You don't see, for instance, Paul in Colossians emphasizing this point about salvation by grace through faith and as opposed to works of the law. You don't see the emphasis on the resurrection, the future resurrection from the dead that you see in 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians. It is boldly claimed then that Ephesians and Colossians are presenting different doctrine, and there's a different doctrinal emphasis. Well, you know, these are different letters to different people with a different purpose. As I said earlier, there is a specific heresy at Colossae that Paul is addressing. When he writes the brethren around the city of Ephesus, he's addressing a particular issue there that wasn't the same issue he's having addressed when he writes the Corinthians. Oh, when he writes the Thessalonians. And yet, these are the kind of criteria that are so often used to suggest that Paul really is the author of these books. I mentioned that it's just sort of a staple of scholarship that the pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, really came from a later generation, like the early, late 1st century, early part of the 2nd century, and didn't come from the hand of Paul. You know, why do they claim that? Well, let me just give you, just in a nutshell, some of the reasons why. Well, the events and the people that are referred to in the pastoral epistles, they don't fit with the events and the people of the book of Acts that recounts Paul's travels and the people he encountered. Well, I would say this. Yeah, they don't fit with the events and people in the book of Acts, but the reason why is the pastorals are written after the book of Acts comes to an end. There's the assumption that is made by liberal scholars that the imprisonment of Acts 28, where the book of Acts ends and Paul's a prisoner there awaiting trial, well, the assumption is made that that imprisonment was the occasion when Paul was found guilty and executed. And that was the end of his life. Well, but that's not what has to be the case. The book of Acts doesn't indicate that. And in fact, later, early Christian writings talk about how Paul was released from that imprisonment and then traveled elsewhere and was arrested a second time. And so it's those events after the book of Acts and the travels and the people that Paul encountered after the book of Acts that the pastorals are referring to. Or it is very often said the church organization in 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, it's too advanced for the first century because Paul in the pastorals is talking about the so-called qualifications for elders and deacons and all that. Well, but you see elders and deacons at the earliest point. Acts 14, Acts 20, Philippians 1, verse 1. No one questions Paul wrote that letter, but he addresses it to the church at Philippi along with the overseers and deacons. Well, no, there is no church organization that is of a second century and not a first century in the pastoral epistles. In fact, 1 Timothy and Titus make no distinction between the term bishop and elder as if they referred to two different offices. But you do see that in the second century. But you don't see that in 1 Timothy and Titus. So again, these are some of the arguments that I don't believe are weighty, but they are oftentimes alleged. And here's what you will see, and I'll just close this class session with this. One of the things, and Ray Madrigal's here as a fellow teacher along with me at the Florida College, Ray can certainly attest to this. What you see when you read the literature of liberal scholarship today, especially the undergraduate introductions and the books that are written just for the general populace, what you see over and over again are just assertions of liberal conclusions and liberal dogma with no argumentation. It's just... And the average person out there is just supposed to accept this because Professor so-and-so asserts it. And it just amazes me how so many of these liberal arguments and conclusions are just accepted now without even being debated. Same kind of thing that sometimes happens in modern political circumstances, you know. And what's politically correct and what's the acceptable doctrine. Well, the same kind of thing happens in modern scholarship. There are politically correct conclusions if you want to be an academic scholar of repute. And it's just the day and time in which we live. Now, I'm going to address in this morning's sermon some more particular issues, even some of the knottier problems that you get into when you look at, say, Peter, 1 Peter and 2 Peter and James and Jude. And so we're going to be addressing those in depth during our sermon time. Thank you so much for your kind attention.